might make a start. Hello everyone and welcome to our event, Climate Change and Energy Supply Policy Perspectives from Europe, Asia and Australia. We will be looking at some of the good ideas on climate and energy policy from around the world and at some of the impediments that might exist, and we're hoping to have a bit of a broader conversation as well around climate change issues, so we'll be guided to a degree by you in what you're interested in. My name is Cathy Alexander. I'm a research fellow at the University's Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, which is one of the groups that's brought you today's event. I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting on Wurundjeri land and pay my respects to their elders past and present. In terms of tonight's event, we've had a workshop all day today, which has been really good. People from all over the world. I learned a lot about gas. If anyone has any questions about gas, I can sort you out. There is a degree of institutional complexity in terms of who has brought you tonight's public event, so it's tied to the workshop. Institutional complexity, of course, being very appropriate for the problem of climate change. We have five organisations: the university's new European Union Centre on Shared Complex Challenges, the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, the Australian Institute of International Affairs, the university's Australian-German College of Climate and Energy Transitions, and the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute. We'll be hoping to have a real conversation tonight, so we've encouraged our panellists to discuss things amongst themselves. There is a strict PowerPoint limit, which I've enforced. The way it's going to work is all of our speakers are going to speak for about 6 or 7 minutes on the angle they think is most interesting, to do with climate and energy, comparing our three regions. We'll hold the questions through that. We'll just go through the speakers. We'll then have a conversation between ourselves and involving me for a certain amount of time, and then we'll open up to questions from the audience. There should be two microphones. So if you don't mind saving your questions till when I say they can go ahead, we would love to hear from you. I'll run through our four speakers. Our first speaker is Scott Wyatt. Scott is an advisor on energy, environment, fisheries and forestry for the delegation of the European Union to Australia. Our second speaker is Professor Wan Rung. Wan Rung is Vice Director, Institute of the Urban Environment at the Chinese Academy of Science, Hubei University, Wuhan, China. We then have Professor Ross Garnaut. Ross is a Professorial Research Fellow in Economics here at the University of Melbourne. He's with the Melbourne Institute for Economic and Social Research. And our last speaker is Professor Tim Flannery, who we're very happy to welcome to the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute. He recently joined us there. Tim is a scientist and writer and was Australian of the Year in 2007. So what we'll do is start with Scott.
Okay, good evening everybody. Thanks, Cathy. I've actually got a short statement that I'll read to you tonight. Okay. Anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions have increased since the pre-industrial era, driven largely by economic and population growth, and are now higher than ever. This has led to atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxide that are unprecedented in at least the last 800,000 years. Their effects, together with those of other anthropogenic drivers, have been detected throughout the climate system and are extremely likely to have been the dominant cause of observed warming since the mid-20th century. That was a quote from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fifth Assessment Synthesis Report Summary for Policymakers, which came out just a few weeks ago. Clearly, we have a problem, and the evidence for the existence and gravity of that problem is mounting. All parties have to do their bit. The EU is home to over 507 million people and consists of 28 countries, which, through joining the EU, have chosen to pool their sovereignty in various areas. The EU contributes about 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions. This share has been declining due to lower emissions in the EU and growing overall global emissions. The EU takes climate change seriously, and we're working to play our part and to lead by example. The EU's emissions have dropped over 19% from 1990, while at the same time the economy has grown some 45%. We are therefore very much on track to reach our 20% by 2020 emissions reduction target. We also have an EU 20% by 2020 renewable energy target in final energy consumption, where almost all member states have succeeded in meeting their interim targets. Looking at the current policy mix, in addition to the well-known EU emissions trading scheme, which is the centrepiece of our mitigation policy. There are plenty of other areas where the EU has enacted stringent targets, policies and standards. Three examples of action at an EU level include a more stringent regulation limiting fluorinated greenhouse gases to come into effect at the beginning of next year. Regarding vehicle efficiency, the EU has an average fleet binding greenhouse gas emissions target for cars of 135 grams per kilometre by 2015. Just recently, a new target was set for 2021 of 95 grams per kilometre, which equates to approximately, in the real world, of 4.1 litres per 100 kilometres of petrol, or 3.6 litres per 100 kilometres of diesel. The European Commission also looked recently at heavy-duty vehicles, better monitoring and reporting standards are proposed as an important first step in further policy measures in that area. The EU labelling of tyres came in from 2012 and includes the compulsory display of information on fuel efficiency. So whether you're buying a new set of tyres in the UK or Portugal, you've helped to make an informed choice. Addressing climate change calls for a long-term view and long-term commitments, and I'm pleased to report we have already been busy looking beyond 2020. 1 month ago, the European Council, that's the meeting of the heads of state of the 28 countries that make up the EU, agreed on the 2030 Climate and Energy Policy Framework for the European Union. Importantly, the European Council endorsed a binding EU target of at least a 40% domestic reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 compared to 1990. With respect to renewables beyond 2020, the Council also agreed to an EU target of at least a 27% share of renewable energy consumed by 2030. This target will be binding at an EU level. There was also agreement on an indicative target of a 27% improvement in energy efficiency. The IPCC's fifth assessment makes for an unpleasant wake-up call for what we potentially face if we don't take some serious changes in the way we do things. However, we have no sensible choice but to face this reality head-on. One personal observation I'd like to make concerns some of the uncertainties in modelling and projections. Whilst one might hope the temperature increases, the ocean's changing pH, sea level rise, and all the associated impacts end up on the more benign end of scientists' projections, the corollary is that it could easily go the other way, and that's one set of scenarios we'd best avoid. Finally, it's important not only to consider the merits and impacts of various mitigation options, but to be ever mindful of the hidden costs of greenhouse gas pollution. The EU sees the considerable economic opportunities inherent in rolling out ambitious climate change policies. Those countries and companies able to innovate, capitalising on forward-thinking policies which recognise the inevitability of a low-carbon future, will build the industries of tomorrow.
Just before we hear from one room, I should have mentioned that we are tweeting tonight. We have a couple of live tweeters, and you can see their handles there, and we have got our own hashtag for the night, so if you want to get in early with your question, please send it to the hashtag, because we will be reading them out. So we'll now hear from one room.
Okay, thank you, Cathy. And good evening, everybody. I think in here, I want to talk something different from I talked in the conference. I want to give you here some figures about. Originally talk about bicycle, but at first I think I can give you some figures about China automobile production capacity, fuel consumption, and so on. And you can imagine how hard the way China to the emission cutting future, how hard, yeah? Now let's get started. And in China, in this year, 2014, Chinese will consume altogether 500 million ton petrol and liquid fuels, yeah, 500 million. And we imported this year around 300. I give you only roughly figures you can imagine. That means 6%, 16% China's fuel wheeled from abroad. And about capacity of automobile in China, we have in China now the capacity of production reached 20 million cars, 20 million. And in China, yes, now, sorry, I think we have altogether 100 million cars altogether. Yeah, 100 million. That's made roughly every 10 persons own one car, or per thousand, yeah, every thousand persons in China or citizen own 100, yeah, roughly 100 cars now. And you can imagine in 10 years, when Chinese buy all the car we produced, yeah, we will 10 plus 20 is 200, yeah, 200 million cars. And plus also yes, 100, now 100, we have 300 million cars for the vehicles, yeah, for the mobile. That's one figures. And it's 10 years, yeah, 2015, also the 2025, another 2024. And you can imagine, USA, yeah, US, now the US citizenship, citizen, 1,000 person, or the 1,000 citizen own nearly 900, yeah. So in China, in 10 years, roughly 1,000 person, 300 cars, that's also difference between current situation with USA. And also you mentioned the car consume or fuel, yeah, fuel consume. I have the statistics in 2008. It said the efficient car utilize or the consumption is in Japan. Per car or every car in Japan consumed 1.1 ton fuel in Japan, and the EU 1.5, and the US 1.8, and in China 2.3 ton every year, 2.3 ton. Now we can calculate 300 million ma or the market 2.3 or 2. Or 1.1. This doesn't matter. That means in the 10 years, only the cars consume 330 million ton or up to 450 million ton. Yeah. That means China today altogether, yeah, altogether consume 500, yeah, but in the future only the cars, vehicle consume 450 million tons of the fuel, yeah. But you can imagine in 10 years, yeah, 10 years later, we have per thousand person only have 300, but in US, yeah, we, now it's per thousand 900. Yeah, there's also already difference. You can imagine that in China, there are a huge demand of the fuel in the world. And actually, I want to talk about bicycle. China was known as bicycle kingdom. Yeah. And in my generation, I think in Beijing and in Shanghai, also in my hometown, full of bicycle to work, go home, and so on. And now in China, biking is growing in city. I might think not in China, in the world, biking is growing across the world. Yeah, biking is growing. But in China, due to auto-centric policies, in China it's very hard to bike. To bike. Somebody said Chinese are lazy. Now, they want to find taxi, go work, go home. And somebody also said in China, it's hard to find real bicycle paths. Yeah. So I think for China in the future, the really impediment you said, yeah, what impediment I think, when someday when a bicycle or the bicycle rider can say, it's okay in China at the right time, maybe China getting really emission cut. Thank you very much.
And it's interesting, I think what Wan Rong has just illustrated for us in a really interesting way is the harsh reality that people in China cannot live the energy lifestyles that people in the US and Australia live. They can't do that and have any chance of keeping global warming to 2 degrees. Is that fair? Well, maybe it's not, but it's the reality that we face. So our next speaker is Ross Garnaut.
Tim and I are both talking about Australia, so Tim will talk about where we're going, especially in some of the numbers on the electricity sector. And I'll talk about a little bit about how we've got to where we are and talk more generally. And I'll talk a bit about energy for households as part of our standard of living, keeping warm and keeping the television on and driving a car, a bit on energy for industry and for transport. Historically, Australia has had cheap energy, based on an abundance of fossil fuels, especially coal. From the early days of white settlement, we were an exporter of coal taken in bunkers to Southeast Asia. It meant that households had relatively cheap energy for warming and for electricity from an early stage. It meant that we tended to develop energy-intensive industries. And as a result, very early more so over time, we had a relatively carbon-intensive economy, and that wasn't a problem when we didn't know the external costs that we were creating. Ignorance is bliss. In the old model in Australia, we went to great lengths to make energy especially cheap for industry. The costs of our transmission, electricity transmission, gas transmission systems were heavily biased towards keeping energy low cost for an aluminium smelter or some other metal smelter or a steel mill. We tended to push costs onto households because state governments, which ran the state energy systems, favoured industry over households. We tended to reserve fossil fuels for industry so that the state electricity commissions were given privileged access to coal, and they weren't allowed to export that. They just used it for electricity, and we gave our very best coal resources to our big industrial users. BHP was given free of charge Australia's best coking coal reserves all over the country, and best iron ore reserves because it was our steel producer, and that further encouraged the growth of energy intensive industries. We began to change some of those things with the internationalisation of the economy from the mid-80s. First, we internationalised the oil market. We used to control the price of oil and allocate domestic crude amongst oil refineries. Well, we freed that up, just became part of the global oil market in the mid-80s. And over the last decade or so, 1.5 decades, we did something very similar to coal. We separated ownership of coal reserves from domestic use. BHP became a miner and not steel maker, the State Electricity Commissions and their privatised successors were allowed to export coal. So the cost of energy, coal, tended to rise to international prices, to export parity prices. That didn't happen immediately in Eastern Australian gas because it wasn't economic in the past to export Australian gas. But with gas markets growing and global prices for gas rising and new technologies becoming available for expanding gas reserves, we are just now in the process of internationalising our Eastern Australian gas resources, developing export industries in, especially in Gladstone in Queensland. We used to have gas prices about one third of the average for developed countries and about one third of the United States. So this was a very cheap environment for gas using industries. Melbourne, Geelong became big centres of petrochemical and gas using industries. Well, with the we're now moving towards international prices for gas. Anyone who owns gas reserves in Bass Strait or Moomba or the Cooper Basin can sell them to an exporter. So naturally, price is on the way up to international prices. Right at the moment, it's not, because there's a temporary surplus because all the coal bed methane that's being developed for export is just pouring onto the domestic market at the moment. So just now, there's an artificially low price. But that's going to lift. And so instead of having prices a third of those of the United States, we'll have prices for domestic gas two or three times those of the United States. So through this internationalisation, we have ceased to be a low-cost energy country. And that means that where we were once a congenial location cost-wise for energy-intensive industries, but as a result of our trade policies, which on the whole I think are reasonable policies, we will cease to have cheap energy. We will see, as the gas price rises, a massacre of gas-based manufacturing in Melbourne and Geelong. Not much talk about that yet, because we don't look very far ahead, but that's on the way. Now, household costs of gas have also, and coal and electricity have also been rising for the same time. Domestic costs have also risen greatly because we have made a unique set of mistakes in the way we regulate gas and electricity transmission and distribution. We provide a high guaranteed rate of return so that the more that a transmission company invests in the system, the higher the value of the company, because they automatically get a high price. So that's another reason why we're becoming a high-cost, not a low-cost energy country. When we introduced carbon pricing, it was introduced into that context, and hard though some of us might work to try to explain the origins of very large changes in the energy price situation in Australia. Those who were opposed to carbon pricing managed to associate the whole of these very large increases with one small component of it, which was the result of carbon pricing. Now, higher energy prices do reduce energy consumption, including in households, and that's one of the reasons why, since 2008, for the first time except in recession or wartime, energy use has been falling in Australia a couple of percent per annum. When you've got a guaranteed rate of return for your transmission system, that means you've got to jack up the price as the consumption falls. Before, we had to jack up the price because with expanding demand, new investment was required, and you had to give the guaranteed rate of return on a bigger network. Now we've got to jack up the price because demand's falling. That's a bit of a puzzle for some people, but we cop it both ways. Our industry is going to go through some massive structural change as a result of the working through of these adjustments in energy policy. If you have free exports of gas or fossil fuels, you don't have relatively low costs because your prices become the international prices less the cost of transport. This is also the environment in which we started to introduce other carbon policies. And since 2006, but especially since 2008, we've introduced many policies to promote alternative sources of energy, especially renewables. And that has been having quite a considerable effect. It has been growing much faster than had it been anticipated. It's encouraged by the fact that these other policy reasons were driving, were putting downward pressure on fossil fuel use because of the rapid increases in costs and prices. So this was a good environment for introducing policies to promote renewables, and they've gone very rapidly in Australia. To the point where our renewable energy target, which is actually a very ambitious one, looks as if, to my view, we're in a situation where it could be met at a relatively low cost. It's ambitious compared in practice compared, for example, with the European. Now, special thing about most forms of renewable energy is that it's not easily internationally tradable. Another special thing about renewable energy is that the main source of renewable energy are more abundant and lower cost in Australia than in any other developed country. Our position is privileged as much for renewable energy as for fossil fuels, solar, wind, wave, and others. Now, as the whole world moves towards having a higher proportion of renewable energy in the mix, and if you read last week's annual update of the International Energy Outlook from the International Energy Agency, you see a written into that very strong expectation of renewable energy component of all developed countries, all countries' energy use. Then our advantage in low-cost renewable energies becomes more and more important, because it's something that's not taken away by international trade. So this might be a permanent and sustainable advantage, which, if we play our cards right in developing renewable energy, could be a way of getting back the relatively cheap energy and the comparative advantage in energy-using industries that we used to have.
Mm. So just possibly wind and solar could be the new coal for Australia, is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Great. Well, thank you, Ross. And I think your summary, really, of the Australian energy situation as resulting from a unique combination of mistakes is a very illuminating one. And I really just want to take your the background you've given us there and just ask a few questions about Australia's energy future. Are we likely to make targets set to reduce emissions? Where is the energy going to come from? And how is, in the context you were talking about, Ross, how are we going to fit into an international action plan, if you want, that may result from the Paris meeting next year? So I'm just, I'm going to have to come across to the side here because I understand that it's very difficult to, in fact, impossible to read the pointer, so I'll be using my hands. I've only had about 3 days to digest the impact of this particular announcement, the US and China deal on climate change, ambitious emission cuts in the US, and the first time in China that a cap has been announced for emissions overall. I guess my gut feeling, though, and I'd be interested, Ross, in your view, is that this is fundamentally a game changer, because it has, between them, these two countries represent somewhere around 43% of global emissions. And for them to make an announcement in advance of the meeting, and a relatively ambitious one, at least on the part of the US, I think will lead to changes. So where does Australia fit in all of this? In the year to September 2013, our total greenhouse gas emissions were 542 million tonnes, and by far the largest part of the pie, if you divide the emissions up, is electricity generation. So we're still dependent on coal-fired power plants, many of them quite old, some of them among the most polluting on the planet. So just to give you a sense of that, if you compare China's new supercritical coal-fired power plants and their performance with, say, our plants in the Latrobe Valley, some of our Latrobe Valley plants produce 1.6 tonnes of carbon dioxide for every megawatt of electricity generated. The new Chinese plants produce about 257 kilograms of CO2 for each megawatt of electricity generated. So we're dealing with old plant here that's not, it's highly polluting and not very efficient. So if you break it down where the emissions are coming from in Australia, this is roughly what things look like. The top line here is the electricity sector, which has been the largest proportionally, but you can see beginning in about 2008-2009, we've started to see a decline, and I think Professor Garno put it very modestly. It was the fear of price rises was probably an important factor in driving the price down. Our current Prime Minister was one of those speaking loudest about the potential of catastrophic price rises in electricity, so perhaps we should call this the Abbott effect in part. Investments in gas, of course, have had a role to play there as well, as has renewable energy as well, because what you don't see here is the electricity generated from rooftop solar PV. That's not traded into the market in the way that some reported in this particular graphic. And Australia has done remarkable things with rooftop PV. In 2007, there was, I think, about 8,000 grid-connected units. Today, there's 1.3 million. Compare that with the USA, where there's still only about 500,000 grid-connected solar rooftops in the US. So a number of factors are affecting this. What we don't see here, unfortunately... Oh, sorry, the other thing I should talk about here is the this big dip anticipation of a carbon price, and the actual impact of the carbon price meant people started to switch fuels. They weren't burning as much coal, but using hydro, burning some gas, and using renewables. So we've had 5 years of good effort there, starting to reduce. Unfortunately, what we've seen since the repeal of the carbon tax, so after July this year, is a big rebound in terms of coal use. Of course, there's no more tax to be paid on emissions, so you go back to the old infrastructure and put more coal through it. Just prior to the carbon tax abolition, we got the coal as a percentage of the energy mix was down about 69% or thereabouts. In the first quarter following the abolition of the carbon tax, it had gone up to above 76%. So at that rate, if we extrapolate out for a 12-month period, it's likely that we'll lose all of those gains made over the 5 years from the electricity sector. So emissions will continue to rise in that area. Transport continues to rise. We don't have fuel efficiency standards for motor vehicles in this country, although obviously we benefit from emission standards and from standards overseas for imported vehicles. But things will likely continue to rise there. A very big rise here in fugitive emissions. So these are emissions associated with the gas industry and the coal industry, but particularly the coal industry. And as that's boomed, fugitive emissions have continued to grow as well. So I guess if you kind of sum all of that up, you can see that there's been an inexorable upward trend in emissions in Australia until last year, when our combined emissions fell by just under 1%, 0.8% overall. And the economy continued to grow through that decline. So we finally joined the nations of the world where we decoupled emissions growth from economic growth. I think for a number of reasons that's unlikely to continue into the future. One of them is the abolition of the carbon tax. The second is the big effect that gas is having in this country that Ross Garno mentioned. We are going to develop a large export industry for gas. We already have some, but these gas hubs on the East Coast will ramp up exports. And to export gas, you have to compress it. So the energy to compress that gas is likely to come from Queensland's coal-fired power plants. We'll add about 600 megawatts of demand eventually for the stuff that's grid-connected there, so we'll be burning even more coal to service that particular demand. We also have some standalone compression units. So this is where people will use natural gas to compress natural gas. It's not grid-connected. That will add another 1 to 200 megawatts. I think around 200 megawatts, best estimate, of new emissions, of new electricity demand, and therefore emissions come from burning gas. So I guess my big question is, for Australia, where are we going to get the reductions from? When you look at it on this scale, on going into the future, what sort of policies are going to be required and will be acceptable to the Australian people and the government in order to see us flatten out again, meet the 5% reduction target, or if we're ambitious, meet a greater target that's concordant with that that the US and China have announced and the EU has announced. So these are big questions for the country. I think when you get down to the nitty-gritty, it starts looking difficult. We obviously need a game changer, and perhaps some Ross may have more to say about what that might be. But I'll leave it there, and thank you very much.
So we'll just have a panel discussion for a little while and then throw open to the audience in about 20 minutes, so work on your best questions. I wanted to start with a very curly one for Tim and or Ross. We've had some interesting developments in recent days with the US-China deal, China announcing that it would peak its emissions by 2030, perhaps before. We've also had the G20 and various comments or perhaps hints have been made about Australia's ambition on climate change, particularly from Obama, but he's not the only one. We may be entering a dynamic where there is increasing criticism internationally of what Australia is doing on climate change, the perception it's not doing enough. My question is, do you think that will make any difference to the federal government, or do you think the federal government will say that's it's not a problem for them? Do you think we can expect that Australia might respond to what looks like growing pressure?
There's no doubt there is growing pressure. I think it was very uncomfortable for Australia at the APEC and the G20 meetings. We were out of step with the international community, even on one matter where that hasn't been a matter of high profile objection by the government, contribution to the Global Green Fund. We even lost our denialist ally, Canada. They decided to contribute to the Green Fund. That's not a position that Australia is accustomed to being in. I don't think many Australians are comfortable about being in such a position. Perhaps especially uncomfortable about being in that position in relation to an American president. And especially an American president who's particularly popular in Australia. So there is a pressure on Australia, and that discomfort will grow. It could increase, it could extend to having trade implications, at least with some countries. Will all of that affect positions of Australian government? Well, I was at a forum last night at this university, just in the economics faculty down there, and former leader of the opposition, John Hewson, was asked exactly this question, and he said, Tony Abbott used to, this is John Hewson's talking, used to be a member of my staff, used to be my press secretary, and I found that he was a man of very flexible principles. that when political advantage shifted, his views shifted. And he said, so it would not be out of character for him to adjust his position once it becomes very clear that the political weight is on the other side. But whether he will form that judgment quickly is a different question. But certainly there will be large political costs for the government and reputational costs and costs of lost influence in the international community if we retain a position so far at odds with the international community as that which we have now?
I think there's another risk there that we tend not to think about much, which in this age of growing social media, the possibility of non-governmental backlashes and sanctions, I think are very real. And I think back to the French nuclear testing in the Pacific and Mururoa Atoll, and the sort of backlash that was experienced here in Australia against anything French. It was, I remember, our French bakery people were up in arms because there was kind of all sorts of insults being traded over the table, and people refusing to buy their baguettes and so forth. And I just wonder, I mean, Australia, we are potentially vulnerable. We sell high-value product into the market, which is, it's you know, you don't have to buy expensive wines or good meats and whatever else. And I do worry that if Australia gets a bad reputation as being the rogue element in terms of a global climate deal, whether there'll be other pressures outside government, but social pressures, particularly among young people, to do things that may express their displeasure.
Excellent. I have a question.
Kathy, yep. Perhaps if I could just venture. Obviously, it's inappropriate for me to comment on the politics of all this, but I would make the point that if China and the US collectively, in some magical scenario, curtail their emissions to zero overnight, that would not solve climate change. We really need to bring all countries on board in addressing this global problem. And in terms of numbers and percentages and things like this, someone put it to me the other day, for example, that, as I mentioned in my remarks, there are 28 countries that make up the EU, and the EU contributes 10% of global emissions. Well, imagine if we had Germany or the United Kingdom saying, you know, listen, you know, we really should be taking a back seat on this. We really shouldn't be doing anything because we're such a tiny percentage of global emissions. This problem is not going to be solved unless we have concerted global international action, especially by the developed countries.
I had a question for Wan Rong about the recent deal between the US and China on emissions on climate change, which certainly took some commentators by surprise. I wanted to know, for you and for people in China, was it expected that this deal would happen, or did it surprise people? How have people in China responded to the deal?
Okay, for me, from education circle, was a surprise. Yeah, was a surprise. I understand the background, and I think when I come from university, my students, I mean from university, 90% students cannot understand what the complex is. So generally said, my students cannot understand what the means between China and the US. I mean, generally, in China, the topic of climate change or the policy in China is, also the very top level, in the very top level. And we have calculated also the 2030, these things, the peak, yeah? Mm-hmm. And we said maybe okay. We calculated our peak, how peak comes in China 2030. Really things is China have. New status, we call it new normal. That means China will, in the long term, in the future, will have decreased economic development as the first thing. That means we will demand not as a big number as today, yeah, fuel and so on. And another thing, China expected also the international fuel order, fuel marketing can keep today's price. I mean, China calculated now that before it the oil price is $100 and so on or above. Now it's 78 or 80. For China, it has more space to plan its energy structure.
Yeah, and also China hoped or expected the nuclear power development in the future. from three field, China can relative confidence that we will have the peak in 2030.
But you said earlier today you thought emissions might actually peak around 2027 under current policies in China. Is that correct?
This is one research result.
Yeah. Okay. That leads me to a question actually about the different emissions targets. I'm talking particularly about the post-2020 targets. So we have Scott here from the EU. The target there is cuts of at least 40% by 2030 compared with 1990 levels. In China, we have the promise to peak emissions in 2030 or perhaps earlier. Australia doesn't have a post-2020 target, and we also have the US target of a 26 to 28% cut. What I wanted to ask the panel is this enough? Are any of those regions not doing enough to stay within the 2-degree warming goal that we're supposed to have? Scott said the European Union wants to lead the way. Is that target actually enough from the European Union? Did you have a thought on that, Ross, how those targets stack up?
Well, it's a pity that everyone is using different base years in 1996 Europe, because that was just before the effects of Margaret Thatcher getting stuck into the coal industry really came through, and it's just before the collapse of the highly emissions-intensive, inefficient economies of East Germany and other East European members of the of what's now the European Union. So 1990 is a bit too convenient a base for the European Union. For us, actually, there's not much difference between 1990 and 2000. A little bit of difference, not all that much, but using 2005. But I think there is a problem going back to 1990. I don't think the European target is particularly ambitious. I think the US target is at least as ambitious as the European. And if we thought of ourselves as matching the US, then I think we'd be in the right sort of space. On the Chinese target, it's taken massive structural change in China and huge changes of trajectory for peaking by 2030 to be possible. But a lot of that structural change is already taking place now with the new model of economic growth that was implemented first of all in the 12th five-year plan 2011 to 2015, deliberate increase in the profile of environmental amenity, deliberate downgrading of the role of investment and with its huge implications for energy use and metals use. The systematic encouragement of all low-emission sources of energy, hydro, solar, wind, nuclear, all of them growing very rapidly. Nuclear is growing very rapidly, but wind overtook it last year. Nuclear used to be more important than wind, but wind overtook nuclear last year. They're both growing very fast, wind growing much faster, solar growing fastest of all. So all of these things, I've done a paper published in the journal China and World Economy that just traces through the implications of policies that have already been announced in China on all of the low emissions energy and on energy efficiency. And that suggests to me that for the electricity sector, a peaking about now of emissions is quite feasible and might actually happen anyway, because coal use is starting to tail off. As Wang Ren told us, there are some special challenges in transport, and if the current type of car, the internal combustion engine, remain the main vehicle, then transport alone would make it very difficult for Chinese emissions to peak. But I'm very impressed by Chinese progress on the electric car, and I spent some time with BYD in South China just a few weeks ago. The investment in the battery and in the technology of the car. Recently, they've entered a a joint venture for part of their production range with Mercedes, which brings in extra technology at the high performance end. The official policy is to have 5 million electric cars on the road by 2020. Once you start to get that, you start to get the scale that brings costs down, the same sort of thing that's happened with wind and with solar. So don't be surprised if you see a similar transformation in Chinese emissions in the transport sector to those that we've seen in the electricity sector. And of course, if you've got a combination of movement to an electric car and decarbonisation of electricity, then that's a very powerful combination. And very hard to change the trajectory of growth in emissions from industry, coal use in steel and cement. But the new structure of growth is pointing towards early peaking in those areas as well. So 5 years ago, a peaking by 2030 would have been radical to the extent of implausibility. Now it's a very cautious interpretation of business as usual.
It's interesting. Just, Ross, you mentioned the economies of scale and what's happened with cost in renewables and looking at electric cars. I think it's important to think back to who predicted the cost declines for wind and solar. There's very few, if anyone, did it, I think. And this is one of the things about technological change. It's really hard to look forward. And I've shared your optimism about electric vehicles. I think they're quite important. And, you know, people say, well, will they then add a lot more to the stationary electricity demand? And if you look at Germany as a good example of that and said, if you electrified the entire transport fleet in Germany, how much demand would it add to the state network? It's about 20%. It's not a huge amount. So I think there's reasons for technological optimism, but can we afford to bet the bank on it? That's the question.
Well, we should bet the bank on it.
We've heard some interesting queries raised about the abilities to model and predict, because Scott raised that earlier, some concerns around how accurate it is, and you've done the same thing. So perhaps there's some work for academics to refine this. Would you like to make a point?
I see, yeah. I'd like to know, nobody to the panel comes politician, comes to geograph, comes to economist. Maybe a question to Professor Plenary, or Flannery, sorry. And I think you are special to animal and also museum, and how are you popular here in the climate change issues?
Beats me, I don't know the answer to that question. But I'm a paleontologist by training, and I guess my interest in climate initially was one of the geological aspects of climate change. And then I spent time as a modern mammalogist to assess some impacts of climate change with rising tree lines in New Guinea. I don't know. All I can say is that in about 2001, I was asked to help the South Australian government actually develop some of its policies and things. And I came to the conclusion that Australians didn't understand enough about climate change, so I wrote a book about the subject, which became a popular book, and perhaps that's how I got it.
Tough question.
No one listens to me anyway.
I think I wouldn't say that. Yes. So I just wanted to very briefly address a couple of the points raised by Ross, and I think he does have a point about the confusion around base years, and particularly for those that aren't immersed in the world of climate change, it can certainly make for some very confusing analyses. So the first point I wanted to make was that the EU15, so the older member states outside of those that had the big transformations after the collapse of communism, their emissions have also dropped. In respect to the relative level of ambition of the 40% announcement, I guess I'd make a couple of points. So firstly, I think that, of course, that the 40% is ambitious. I think it will require some pretty significant, if not even monumental, changes and restructuring in the EU. I'd say also that point out that the language mentioned that it would be at least a 40% reduction. I would also say that the point to the fact that the 28 countries of the EU have managed to reach agreement on not only the target but many of the other aspects around the target, and that the EU has not only put forward this level of ambition but it's also agreed to the main elements of how it intends to get there, which is very, very significant. So what needs to happen now is that will be translated into legislation, but we already have the in-principle agreement of the 28 countries that make up the EU. I'd also say that the EU has committed publicly to a 80 to 95% reduction by 2050. And lastly, just in respect to targets in general, I think I'm glad Ross sort of raises this point, because one of the strong EU opinions is that we need information around the parties' proposals, what's termed in UNFCCC speak as their intended nationally determined contributions. So we need a decision in the next UNFCCC meeting about what sort of information will accompany the proposals that countries are putting forward, their commitments. And also, I think what's very important is that we then have a space to analyse one another's targets to determine the relative levels of ambition and the fairness and the merits of those targets. But then, following on from the Paris Agreement, we need periodical reviews that will look at whether or not we are, in fact, on track realistically to meet the 2-degree objective.
So you mean Lima, when you say it would be good if that was sorted out around transparency? You mean the Lima conference?
Yes, so the next conference, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. Well, it's now time for questions from the audience. We have about half an hour. I think there are a couple of microphones. Yes, there are. So if you can stick your hand up when you've got a question, please do feel free to identify yourself. People always like to know where you're from. But do try and stick to one question. I'm going to be very tough if anyone tries to squeeze in two. So, if anyone has a question, please stick your hand up. Okay. There's one there at the back.
Hi, Kirsten Taylor. I'm a PhD student in international relations. I'm interested in the backing that Obama actually has to put forward these promises as a lame duck president. Does he actually have any political power to follow through on these promises?
Or is it a present for Hillary? Yeah, very good question. Would anyone like to answer?
Yeah, there was a lot of scepticism here in part of the media and the government about their commitment along the lines of the Republicans control the Congress and won't allow the president to do anything. Well, the president doesn't need any new legislative authority. He intends to reach these targets through use of the established legislative authority through the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, the Congress could vote to repeal that legislation or to amend it. I presume the President would veto it, veto the amendments or the withdrawal, and the Republicans wouldn't have the numbers in the Senate, you know, 2/3 majority to override a veto, so that would stand. I think he's thought that through. Now, a new president could change things. From what I hear, Hillary Clinton, the front runner for the Democrat nomination, is at least as strong as Obama on the objective. Her closest associates in New York include people who have had very high profiles on this issue for a long time, like Robert Kennedy Jr. If her objectives are the same as Obama, we can expect them to be pursued much more toughly, because she is a very tough person. So there's no easy way through for changing action there. Now, if there was a change to a Republican president there in 2 years' time, it may very well be that American objectives would change. although the US continuing to make progress in reducing emissions, and the rest of the world responding to that does change the context even for a president who doesn't want to act on climate change. But yes, that is actually the one risk, that there could be a change to a Republican president at the next election.
Does anyone else want to add anything on that?
Yeah, sure. I can't comment on the politics of it, obviously, but I would say that having the two leaders standing up, the two biggest emitters, making a statement like that is an extremely welcome development, and it certainly injects some positive momentum towards Paris and bodes well for a successful meeting in 2015.
Okay. Who else would have a question? Hands up. Looks like there's one up the back there.
Hi, my name's Daniel. I just had a quick question. At a national level, so the energy policy seems to be driven more like by economic values rather than, you know, climate change and, I guess, preserving the world for future generations. My question is on at a state level, what does the state have in terms of reducing greenhouse gases and ensuring, I guess, more of a fair energy prices for households and consumers going forward, given, the continued interest in developing brown coal in the Latrobe Valley, as well as, you know, very little movement, or if not, a backward step in renewables in Victoria.
So your question was specifically about what Victorian government could do on that?
Sure. We released a report on state performance across the country today, looking at particularly new installed renewable energy. And I was quite surprised to see the differences state by state. And we're all working under the same federal government with the same renewable energy target that's been stable until recently. But some states have done far better than others. And if you look at South Australia, for example, they're really leading on this. They generate about 36% of their electricity now from the wind sector. A quarter of South Australian households have solar panels on the roof. And that's come about through, I think, just a very determined effort by the state government over a number of years to talk to the community about their concerns about things like wind turbines, to work with the energy companies, and to really, I guess, embed the notion that they want to become an energy exporter, an electricity exporter, from the renewable sector. So they've done great things. If you look at Victoria, there's been a pushback against wind in particular here. You can put a coal mine closer to a house in Victoria than a wind turbine. You know? So it's been a very sort of regressive approach to renewable energy here. And I guess, you know, it looks to me, and as an outsider really on this, but it looks to me as if the links between the old State Electricity Commission and the thinking that this was a great asset, that brown coal or lignite's a great asset for the state, needs to be protected, and that the future of electricity generation in Victoria as brown coal is still alive and well at the state level, and that's driving a lot of the thinking around this. All I can say is that states are powerful in this area. If we can get consistency over the long term, you'll get the investment in the state. You know, and just putting it in dollar terms, South Australia's gained about $5.5 billion of investment in the sector. About half of that's gone to the regions, regional South Australia. So there's been big gains there. Victoria, by contrast, has lost about $4 billion worth of investment, or investment that never materialised. And that, of course, translates into jobs as well. So, I think that the states have a big job, big role.
Yeah. Now, another detail on South Australia, 36% wind, about 5% solar. So, and the total would make South Australia if it was a separate country, the country in the world that had by far the highest proportion of wind and solar in the world. So it actually is changing what electrical engineers think about how much wind you can handle, even without storage. Just a note on the Latrobe Valley. It is possible that the Latrobe Valley could have a future as a source of energy, and that depends on carbon capture and storage. And I don't think we should have knee-jerk ideological opposition to carbon capture and storage and use of coal.
if it is effective and is economic, then it can be a significant part of the solution. We're going to have to do lots of things to get to hold temperature increase to 2 degrees. We're going to need a big help from a lot of things, and carbon capture and storage can be part of it. Don't think in binary terms, in terms of it either it works or it doesn't. We know that it does work. Professor Cook's project that he used to manage down in the Otways has shown that the geological dimension of the sequestration is effective. We've got very large scale sequestration from gas emissions in the Northwest Shelf of the Gorgon project, the largest CCS project in the world, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. We need a lot more research and development on this technology, bringing it up to commercial scale. If you ask me to guess, I would say that in favourable locations, coal with carbon capture and storage may very well be, is likely to be economic. Now, not all locations are favourable. It might only be a limited part of total what is now coal-based generation that is suitable for this. You need geological sites that are suitable not very far away. You also need a very low cost of primary energy, because you use a lot of energy in the process of capture and storage. At the moment, again, correct me, Peter, I think at the moment up around 30% of the energy in a plant would be required to capture and store the energy. So you need very low-cost primary energy. You need a place where energy is dirt cheap, and that's the Latrobe Valley. So so in the whole mix of things, there is a place for that, and it may be that Victoria is one of those places in the world where coal has a future, but only with carbon capture and storage. If I can have one more minute. We've seen a very important development last week. The chief executives of the world's two biggest mining companies, which both have very strong associations with Melbourne, BHP and Rio Tinto, acknowledged that there was no future for coal without carbon capture and storage. That's actually a very big step. And that reflects changes in the international situation, and I think changes in the latest international energy agency's report. Now, both those companies played a role in destroying the Australian carbon pricing arrangement. There's no way that a coal-based power generator is ever going to use carbon capture and storage without a carbon price or regulation that forces them to do so, because it's, no matter what the advances in technology, it's never going to be cheaper to capture and store the carbon dioxide than just release it into the atmosphere, which is what we do at present.
Can I just say, I mean, one of the big improvements of the Latrobe Valley, you're right, economically it makes sense, but the problem is the plant is so old. You know, it's getting, a lot of it's getting towards the end of its life. And you're talking about major investments to retrofit old plant. The alternative is to build some new coal-fired power plants and raising the capital to do that when you've got competition from renewable energy, you know, with the price declining every year, I think is going to be a challenge. But could I just say, I've looked at CCS in good faith, thinking maybe it's going to produce an outcome. I've lost that faith recently. I think the cost overruns and the time overruns for the two trial plants in Canada and the US are just the beginnings of problems. And then there's the economics of it. But there is some really interesting science around carbon capture and storage that might, in the future, after 2050, give us some leads. One of them's come out of astrobiology. People have been looking at the formation of the CO2 polar caps on Mars and asked, under what conditions does CO2 precipitate out of an atmosphere? It turns out that over the high Antarctic, you only need to drop temperatures by a further 20 to 30 degrees Celsius to see the CO2 precipitate out of the air as snow. Antarctica has got a fabulous wind regime, more wind than you could ever use. You need about twice the installed capacity of Germany to start pulling gigawatts of CO2 out of the atmosphere as snow in the Antarctic. We'd bury it under ice and hopefully it would stay there. But maybe 30 years or 40 years from now, we're thinking about CCS in a very different way. Of course, that's science fiction today, But I think that if we look into the science of it, maybe there's, you know, we get to 2050, we say, well, we're way over the wise, we're committed to more than 2 degrees. Maybe we look at other forms of CCS.
I don't know what to make of that technology, and nor does anyone else. Hands up, who has got a question? We have got one here. We have a mic.
Thank you. My name is Katerina. I'm from Climate for Change. Tim, you mentioned a game changer, and I wondered if the panel might have some ideas on what the game changers might be. And in particular, I'm from the grassroots sector, and I wondered what role we have to play in changing that game.
Sure. I think one, just looking at energy technologies, there's a number of potential game changers out there, that's for sure. I guess one potentially in the distant future might be fusion energy. Something a bit more proximate, I suppose, is the development of energy storage systems. The cost of batteries is dropping dramatically. We're seeing some interesting developments there. There's a big factory in the United States that you might be aware of that's being, as I understand, is being constructed at the moment. So the cost of batteries is coming down. There are other ways to store energy that could help with the deployment of renewables and help with some of the intermittency issues. It's not just batteries. I mean, there's potential in some locations for pumped hydro. So, for example, if you've got the wind blowing, then you've got your wind turbines operating, the wind dies down, and while the wind's been blowing, you've pumped water up to a higher storage level, and then you can re-release it to keep meeting demand and grid stability, that sort of thing. And also, with respect to solar, some of the big solar thermal plants that are coming on stream now, as I understand, have things like salt that heats up, and so you have an energy source that keeps going when the sun's not shining. So you can have somewhat paradoxically, I suppose, solar plants that will give you 24-hour sources of power. So yeah, certainly in the energy area, there's some major game changers afoot.
Okay, we'll take another question.
Could I just say, just as a grassroots person, because you asked as grassroots as well, have a look at AYCC and look at what they're doing with their meter bank manager campaign and so forth. It's really powerful.
Okay, we'll take that question. We have a question down the front here, if we could have the microphone.
Yes, I've told you it's more of a comment than a question. And Ross was absolutely right in his analysis of CCS. Just make one comment for Tim. You mentioned you'd lost faith. Pachauri actually identified CCS just 2 weeks ago as absolutely essential in terms of the IPCC report. He said without CCS mitigation is going to cost us about 30% more. So he's certainly convinced that it has to be part of the equation. You mentioned Canada. Canada, and I know this very well because I'm on the board of the company that's involved with it, they've come in at about 15% over budget. They have now got a fully integrated CCS project based upon not just project, but a plant producing electricity from brown coal. That costs $1.5 billion. Significant part of that budget was actually for refurbishment of 40-year-old boilers. So there are some comparisons. I'm not saying you'd actually want to do that out of choice. Yes, it'd be much better if you had a new plant, but you can do it with a brown coal-fired power station. You can do it retro. So that's a very significant message there. The other one you mentioned, which is in the United States, which is what's called integrated gasification combined cycle one, which is almost like going to the moon in terms of, you know, a very new plant. So yes, that's coming significantly over the budget, probably double or triple the budget. But that also is brown coal, surprisingly enough. And that's because brown coal actually gasifies rather more easily than black coal does. So, you know, it's not necessarily the end of the world for the Latrobe Valley. I think we do, as Ross said, we need to keep an open mind. We can't take a simplistic view of these things. There are a whole range of options. We're going to need all of them.
Peter, would you just like to tell us who you are? I'm sorry.
Peter Cook from University of Melbourne, the Centre for CCS Research.
Great. Another question? Have we got one over here? We might take one down the front there.
Thanks very much. Don Henry from the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute. question for Ross and the other panellists. Just imagine we had the host country of a G20 meeting wanting to put climate action central to the consideration of finance ministers and leaders. And I note the Prime Minister of Turkey is saying he's intending that to happen at the next G20 meeting. Just imagine that was happening. What could a G20 actively do to stimulate and help action on climate change?
I think we've just lost an historic opportunity. Australia punched above its weight, just as we did at the Paris conference in 1919, when we destroyed Woodrow Wilson's conception of a League of Nations based on racial equality and set the scene for another world war. I think the stars were aligned for a great outcome. The US and China lined up some couple of months in advance. Europe and put something strongly on the table. We had the next chair, Turkey, very strongly committed to strong outcomes, and we punched our above our weight and knocked it out.
We'll take another question. Any from that side of the room? We have one up the front here.
I'm going to ask a very different question, because most of the discussion has been about technological fixes to man-made climate change. We have a panel which doesn't have any women on it. We had a G20 which didn't have any women leaders involved.
Merkel.
Not true. Absolutely. One. Okay. The interesting thing is...
Brazil, Korea.
Would we have a different international discussion at the UNFCCC? We had 90% women and 10% men leading the agreements.
Well, interestingly enough, there is a sex bias in terms of people's opinions about climate change. If you look at the CSIRO studies, a higher percentage of women are concerned about climate change and are willing to pay something for it than men. So maybe you're right, maybe we will get a different outcome.
David, our last Commissioner for Climate Action was indeed a woman, Connie Hedegaard, and she did a splendid job, and she's just finished her turn now.
If I can continue in that theme, the world effort in the 90s was led by Margaret Thatcher,
yep.
A conservative leader with a science background herself. And in Europe in the last decade, I think Angela Merkel has been crucial to Europe playing a strong position. Australia's effective carbon pricing policies were led by a woman. And I have foreshadowed that a very tough American woman might get things moving in a couple of years' time.
So the answer is yes.
I think I've been so inspired by David's question that the next question will have to be from a woman. So we have a woman with a question. Now is your big chance. We have one right up the back here, if we can get the microphone there.
Hi, Laura Shervin. I don't have an affiliation, private citizen. Just going back to storage of electricity, is there something that this may be a very silly question, but is there a policy directive that we can work on that would allow storage on the network, that would therefore allow renewable energies to come on board much more as a base load energy source? Because it seems to me that this is an area that is, it's a problem. Everybody says you need to have base load energy, and that's the catch cry. You have to keep it all even all the time. It's real time. So if we had storage put onto the network, is there a way of doing that?
Yes, there is. Well, you can either store on the grid scale and grid level, or at the user level. At the user level, with the exciting technologies to do with improvement of batteries and fuel cells. Some very interesting work in Japan on fuel cells. At the grid level,
Probably it's pumped hydro storage, although you can see the possibility of other, there's a lot of work going on. We do have one regulatory barrier that doesn't help things, and that is that we think of any generation, including for stabilisation of the system through storage, as a generation investment and not as part of the grid. If you put in a large, successful pumped hydro storage facility, it would remove the fluctuations in price and remove the way in which you make profits from a pumped hydro storage, because you buy the power when it's cheap and sell it when it's dear. Well, the operations itself brings them together. In China, they regulate that differently. They treat the storage as part of the grid, and so it's just part of the way you distribute the electricity. State Grid Corporation of China, the world's largest utility by some measures, book capital, the largest company in the world, is in the process of putting in 30 gigawatts of pumped hydro storage with facilities outside each of the major cities in China. They see that as just part of their stabilisation of the grid. You need it both for balancing intermittent energy, wind and solar, but you also need it for balancing nuclear energy, because nuclear power is constant. You can't easily, in the middle of the night, turn it down when everyone's gone to bed and you're not using as much power. So if you don't want to spill, waste the electricity, you use that to pump it higher. The State Grid used to be solely a Chinese corporation. Seven years ago, it decided to become a global corporation, and each year to add one new country to its operations. Bought the Portuguese grid one year, the Philippines another. It's put in all the long-distance transmission in Brazil in another year. A year and a half ago, it bought the Victorian and South Australian grids. So they can do it, but the regulatory framework is not very suitable at the moment.
I'll just say this very, very briefly. There's some really exciting options in battery storage. The City of Toronto in Canada just commissioned 10, I think they're 40 or 400 tonne spinning flywheels that form batteries effectively, because of the energy storing is spinning in these great pieces of steel. That sort of stuff is another option apart from straight batteries. But if you look at Germany, it gives you the answer really. You know, Germany, on a slow day in Germany, you know, wind and solar are producing 70% or more of the energy that's consumed. And yet Germany runs one of the most reliable grids in Europe. So it's not just storage. They have various storage options, but there's other things you do. Demand management, proper grid, a kind of smart grid that allows you to move electricity around. So it, we know from Germany it is doable, it is going to happen, and storage will be part of it.
Just not to put down South Australia. On a slow day, Germany gets up to 70%. On a slow day, South Australia gets up to 100%.
That's right, indeed. And they presumably have the same grid reliability.
We're almost out of time, so what I'm just going to do is throw to each of the panel members in turn if you have a final observation or reflection or perhaps a prediction out of this conversation, or what you'd like to say about climate change and energy. Would you like to start, Scott?
Sure. Well, I guess probably the biggest point that I would make is that the Paris 2015 UNFCCC meeting does represent a tremendous opportunity for us to act globally in a concerted manner to address climate change. It won't be the end of the story. There will be a lot of things that will, even if the meeting is a tremendous success, there will be some details that still need to be worked out in subsequent meetings, and we will need to have this review process that I referred to. But I guess lastly, as I started out saying, I would stress the point that all countries need to come to the table with ambitious proposals that I guess are ultimately backed up with policies that will help achieve those objectives.
One more, would you?
And I must say it's quite interesting, or quite a valuable experience for me. That's my first time in Australia.
I think in the panel, I found that the two very famous experts from Australia know not only about your own things, election, your story here, and so on, but also you are very familiar with Chinese things. For example, you mentioned the pumping station in China for energy storage. Yes, yeah. Respect. Okay. I think maybe for me, I should come here. I mean, in the US and China, joint agreement, we talk about not the agreement and emission cut and so on. We talk about innovation. We talk about technical exchange. I think when we talk about energy storage and family, China is not at the below beginning. Yeah, China is the biggest producer of panel, solar panel, but in China the percentage of usage is very low. Yeah, they are all about these important things, you know, energy storage. Yeah, so I think in the future maybe it's also a big chance here between China and Australia to talk about energy, climate change, also innovation and technology change. So also you are welcome to China.
Ross is actually the former ambassador to China. He's certainly welcome.
There was a question about game changers, and I didn't answer that. We need geostrategic, geopolitical game changers, and I think we had one last week. When the Chinese president and the American president make such strong symbolic commitments, then the game has changed. They won't let people get in their way. I think that's a very important development. Game changers at a community or a personal level, it happens that the technological changes, which, as Tim said, we didn't expect the rate of reduction of costs for solar, especially solar, but solar and wind and other renewable technologies that's occurred. We didn't expect the rate of improvement of battery that's occurred. In Australia, when you combine the big reductions in costs of renewables and storage, combine that with our exceptionally favourable environment for solar and wind in southern Australia. Nowhere else in the developed world's got anything nearly as favourable, especially in combination. Combine that with the irrationality of the regulation of our system, it's created quite strong incentives for expanding local level consumption of renewables. You don't need much more of an increase in price of centralized electricity or much more of a reduction in renewables and battery costs for you to have a revolution in the way we supply ourselves electricity. That would bust apart the established utilities and render redundant a very large part of the established coal-based capacity of generation in Australia, so I'd watch that space.
I guess I'd just like to leave the audience with a question, and Ross has said, I guess in summary, that perhaps technological changes and deployment of clean energy will fix the problem for us, at least in part in Australia. But given what we saw about trends in emissions, I just ask, where are we going to get, what are the mechanisms open to Australia to meet any commitments that will have to be laid on the table this year or next year in order to achieve steep reductions by 2030? So it looks like we're not going to have a carbon price. I think the government's been pretty clear about that. When we're going nowhere with the renewable energy target, so what other options do we have available to us?
Going nowhere is quite a good place to go when your target is 41,000 gigawatt hours.
Well, that's, yeah, I guess so. I guess the default position is that that'll stay. I don't know. Anyway, it looked to me as if we've got a big job if we're going to have steep reductions. I just ask, what are the options? Yep. How are we doing?
The worrying thing about Tim's charts for me is everything other than electricity, actually. Electricity in the short term is going badly. The 100 days, first 100 days of after abolition of the carbon price is just horrible in terms of the reversal of those very favourable trends. But one can see a path for that to be re-reversed. It's going to be much harder with the fugitive emissions from LNG and coal. Quite hard in parts of agriculture, although I'm not against doing everything we can in the carbon farming initiative, but how far we can actually get is a question.
Well, I think we're pretty much out of time. It's been an interesting panel tonight because it's been, to a degree, uncharacteristically upbeat and optimistic in that we have been blending recognition of the scale required to address climate change, the size of the task, with some interesting optimistic observations from pretty much everyone on the panel. So I hope you'll all join with me thanking our four panellists for coming on. The only people left to thank is all of you for coming along. We really appreciate your interest and we hope that you've had a good time and we would like to see you again.